Okay, I'm going to get started. Let's see, mic is on. Okay. So, we're not quite out of the woods yet with concurrent programming. Hopefully today will be the last one, unless if I have something left over which I didn't get to. However, a quick detour. There is an exam next class, in case you forgot, which is after spring break. So I'm going to very quickly go over the material that has been covered and will be included. Today's class is not included. Okay?
So the midterm goes up to last class?
Yeah, it goes up to last class. So I'm just going to go over the material that's posted. Class 1 was nothing. We started with, of course, basics of operating systems, loaders, resident monitors, kind of basic concepts of buffering, spooling, multitasking, and protection. Noisy. Okay. Maybe I'll reduce the volume a little. Protection is kind of important because you've got to really understand how the CPU switches modes. That is, it's always in kernel mode when it's running kernel code and never in kernel mode when it's not running kernel code. And you cannot spoof it any other way. So protection ties in with system calls and interrupts, and all these things work together to make sure that the kernel is protected, as well as applications have the ability to do privileged operations via the kernel, cannot do it directly. After that, we talked about OS structures, OS layers, how do operating systems boot, program to execution, that is I don't remember what I covered there. But we talked about processors, PCBs, and context switching, which by now you've gotten much more familiar with. Context switching, again, and processors and threads, the difference between processors and threads. In the OS context, it often doesn't make a difference, and we interchangeably use processes and threads. But from an application level point of view, processes and threads are very different things. One has a private memory space, the other shares memory space with the parent. Now, processes have states maintained by the operating system, waiting, running, blocked, all kinds of things. We went into the state diagrams and the scheduling queues. Which is essentially the kernel of the scheduling operations or multitasking. Process creation, process cooperation, scheduling metrics, FIFO, SJF, and priority were the three non-preemptive schedulers. We never use non-preemptive schedulers, but that's where we start the teaching about scheduling and scheduling metrics with these three non-preemptive schedulers. Maybe I did system calls once again. And we got into preemptive scheduling, round robin, multi-level queues, and multi-level feedback queues. Multi-level feedback queues form the core of almost every modern scheduler, be it Linux or Windows or all of those. We talked a little bit about schedulers of Windows and Linux and how to evaluate schedulers using traces and some other things. Next was, how does a program really run? You write a high-level language program, C or whatever, and then you've got to compile it, link it, and load it. These are often not very well understood things. Somebody else takes care of it. But I did go into a little bit of detail about how linking and loading works. Again, processes and threads, and how do threads execute? Basically, context switching and scheduling. And since then, we've just been talking about concurrency from various aspects. The railroad problem was kind of a depiction of, contrived story about trains crashing, which is race conditions, and the need for critical sections. And how do you do critical sections? It is not an easy problem to solve, especially if you just want to solve it using plain vanilla software. Then there is the two process software solutions, essentially Peterson solution. Decker's is too complicated. Lamport Bakery solution is an end process solution. But these things are not quite practical. So in real life, we use test and set and or interrupt disabling. With the single core machines are going away, so it's essentially test and set. Interrupt disabling is no longer being used because, single core machines is the only place where you can use interrupt disable. So what is test and set? Its properties and how do you use it for locking? And then we went into this slightly more higher level concept called semaphores, because at that point I didn't talk about it, that semaphores, we will tweak it to be blocking and not busy waiting. And that's the gain in using semaphores other than something like test and set, which is busy waiting. Also, semaphores, as we'll see, provide synchronization, which test and set does not provide synchronization. It provides critical sections only. And there's a big difference. Synchronization gives you the richness of programming strategies and situations you can handle. So how do we use semaphores? We started by basically talking about simple mutual exclusion and synchronization strategies. Then I spent a little bit of time talking about the class project, which is that you by now done probably. When was the due date? So today. Okay, so most of you gotten it to work, so at least you've got a scheduler going over there. The producer-consumer problem, one of the simplest yet the most powerful and the most common case. It's used very, very often in operating systems as well as in application programming. So the producer-consumer problem, how do you do that? Followed by the readers and writers problem, the standard solution has starvation. So I talked about solutions without starvation. And I gave you two versions. And dining philosophers, two versions, one with deadlock and one with starvation. So we didn't go into the much more complex dining philosophers without starvation. That's a harder one. So this was the section on how to use semaphores to build programs which are reasonably complicated synchronization situations, readers and writers, dining philosophers especially. But these semaphores can be implemented in a variety of ways, including blocking, busy waiting, Dijkstra-style semaphores, or much more fairer semaphores. And I showed you how to actually do it in the scheduler you've written so that you can implement semaphores, which is the next project. And I mentioned monitors, definition and semantics, and that's where I'll kind of start up today. So that's the coverage. I'll take questions or I'll continue talking about.
How many questions will it be?
Lots. No, I mean, depends on the length of each question, 4 or 5, something like that.
4 or 5 questions.
Test is during class hours, so that's the length of the test.
Is it going to be mostly conceptual problems, or is there going to be a mix of semaphore?
It could be coding, as in pseudocode, or solve this problem, or calculate, turnaround time or something like that, or show a schedule. Something you will work out. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, do you do note sheets at all?
Do I do what?
Note sheets to bring for the exam?
You can bring anything you want.
Oh, it's open up then.
Yeah.
What
what do you mean? It'll be short questions.
Okay, sure.
Depends. You may think it's not very short, but it's really short questions. Yeah.
So you said that four questions is maybe like A, B, C, D?
Oh, there may be subparts, yeah. Yeah, you can bring notes, you can bring books, you can bring anything you want. But that's about it. Okay? Okay, so we need to finish off the stuff with monitors. And I've talked about monitors. It's a set of methods. Methods execute in critical sections. There's a wait on a condition, always blocks, so it wakes up a thread if there is any thread. Else, it's a no-op. It has no effect. It doesn't remember that you've done a wake-up. So it's memoryless. Okay? So that's what monitors are. And I went over a little complex semantics of signal, because when you wake somebody up, it's going to execute in a critical section. So do you pass the critical section over? Do you hold it? Or you can hold it until you're done, and then you can pass it over. Most implementations don't quite pass it over. They just let anybody get in there, which is technically wrong, but that's how the implementations tend to do it. Okay, so now let me continue with this, and then I'll talk about. So to do something with semaphores, to monitors, we can go back to the same problems that we talked about earlier and see how much difference it makes. So producer-consumer will have a produce routine, which is the one that puts the item in the buffer and blocks if the buffer is full. So you should have count equals to zero is the initialization of a counter, and the produce routine will be I'll write the consume routine also. So remember, the produce routine is a method in a monitor. So it always executes in a critical section. So I don't have to worry about race conditions on this counter. On the value checked, this counter, all this will be atomic, it'll be in a critical section, so that's fine. So if the count is equal to n, count is the number of items already in that buffer. The buffer is this array, circular array, with in and out pointers. I'm not showing the in and out pointers here because I don't want to write it down, but add item to buffer will be buffer equals item. Somewhere you've got to you put the item in and then you increment the in with mod 5. Okay, so that's kind of pseudocode here. And so you increment the counter. If the counter was less than n, it will go to n. And if it was equal to n, that means there's no space in the buffer, you block. And after you're done, there is this signal here, which you see, it'll signal the other guys, but it'll signal the consumer. There are two conditions, producer and a consumer. Should you signal the consumer? Are there any consumers? We don't care. If there are no consumers, it has no effect. If there is a consumer, then I know I added something. So somebody is waiting. I wake that waiting person up. Okay? So it lets you be a little sloppy in code. And the consume would be pretty much the same if pretty much mirror image. Again, count is the number of items in the buffer. You cannot consume if there's zero items in the buffer, so you've got a block. And if there is a non-zero numbers of items, you can decrement count and take an item. And signal the producer if there's any producer sleeping. So if you get woken up, are you guaranteed that the count will be not zero? Because you came in, count was zero, you got blocked. After you wake up, you're not checking whether the count is zero or not. How do you know the count is going to be will be greater than zero?
You only get woken up from produce after count is increment.
Yes, you get woken up by a producer who increments the count. Now, if you have a faulty implementation, you've got to watch out, because after this signal, the producer signals the consumer who's waiting, gets out. Now, the consumer has to acquire the critical section. What if some other consumer acquires the critical section first? That's not good. So, you may want a while loop up here if your implementation is faulty. I'm assuming that the implementation is correct. That is, this signal will wake up a waiting producer, waiting consumer, and not just open the door and let anybody in, which is how pthreads implements it, which is a wrong implementation. Okay? So in a correct implementation, I don't have to recheck. That's it, I'm done. So, is this code easier to understand than the same code written with semaphores? I think you could argue that it is. Okay? Any questions about this? If you're not sure how it works. Of course, I have assumed that there's a loop, produce is a method called by the producer to insert, then the producer generates another item, spends some time in the remainder section, comes back and produces another. You could have multiple producers and multiple consumers here because everything, every produce and consume is in a critical section. So this is a multiple producer, multiple consumer implementation. Yeah.
Count is number of items
currently in there. Initialize it to zero and you go from there. So let's do the starvation-free readers and writers. The starvation-free readers and writers, let's see, what do we need? We will need the same set of variables as the previous one, reader count, writer count, waiting readers count. No, we don't need waiting readers. Yeah, we do. I'm running out of space. Read and write a conditions. There are four integers, the four counters, how many readers are reading, how many writers are writing, how many are waiting. They're all initialized to zero. The conditions are two conditions, one to make the readers wait, one to make the writers wait. We use the same things for the semaphore case. RC is reader count, WC is writer count, RWC is reader waiting count, and WWC is writer waiting count. So reader entry. Now, moment, this is a method, so moment you come here, you've got a critical section. So, what you've got to make sure is if WC greater than zero or WWC greater than zero, so then you do a wait. You're not allowed to enter if there's a writer already in there or writers are waiting because we want a starvation-proof solution. And if you come out then, no, before you do a wait, you have to do a RWC++ and after that RWC minus minus. So that's three statements are within the context of the if. If you come out of the if, that means you're safe, somebody woke you up because the conditions are okay, in which case you An exiting writer will wake up one reader, and here's the cascade. The readers will wake up subsequent readers. I'm not checking RC at all, because if there is no readers, the read dot signal, I should have said signal read. Okay. Reader exit is decrement RC. If RC is not zero, there are more readers already in there. But if RC is zero, that means the last reader is out. Now, you should wake up a writer if there is a writer sleeping. But with this signal thing, I don't care. I just wake up a writer even if the writer is not there, because it will default to a no op. Maybe a little more intuitive than the semaphore version, but this thing here is kind of bit of an eyesore. What's this signal doing? Well, you know about the cascading of readers when you hand over critical sections. Monitors are supposed to hand over critical sections, so we use the same technique. That is, you wake up one, and then slowly they will wake up the next few. And if you did wake up a bunch by doing a lot of signals, it will not work right. You cannot signal ahead. There's no guarantees it'll be memorized. Okay? Only one will wake up. It won't work. Okay, but I was jumping ahead. I didn't show you the reader entry and the exit. I mean, the writer entry and the exit. Okay. Writer entry is pretty intuitive. If you're not allowed to enter, that is WC is greater than zero, writer's inside, or RC is greater than zero, either or, then you go to sleep, update the counters. When you enter, increment WC. And when you exit, decrement WC. Now you're the last writer out, because there can be only one writer. What do you do? Who do you wake up? There may be readers and writers waiting, or nothing. So if there are readers waiting, you give reader preference, that avoids starvation. So if there are readers waiting, you're allowed to wake up one thread, one process. You either wake up a reader or you wake up a writer. What if there's nobody waiting? Then you still wake up a writer, which just falls flat. Maybe that's sloppy code, but that's how I chose to write it. Yeah.
So would it matter if you woke up a reader, if there was nobody waiting?
No, but you would have to, it wouldn't matter. But if you wake up a reader by not checking this, then you could be starving writers. So you've got to decide. So, and you can't wake up both. So. Any questions? So we got done pretty fast over this, unless you want to go over this in some detail or have doubts. Yeah.
What would happen without the else if you just had a single writer at the very end?
Two different things. So if you'll have both then, signal read, signal write.
Right.
In which case, if possible, you'll wake up one reader and one writer. That would be wrong. So you can do either signal read or signal write. So how do you structure that? If you just did signal read, you would have, if you just did signal read and there were no readers, a writer would still be waiting with the room empty and will get stuck for unnecessarily. So you should be doing a signal write, so that's why I put. No, it's more interesting if you just did a signal read, that writer is waiting, no reader. Readers won't go in, other writers will go in. Yeah, that would be wrong. If you just did a signal read and no signal write, you would get into a situation that when you exit, a writer is waiting. Now, after you do that, you signal read, there are no readers. Newer readers will not enter because there's a writer waiting. The waiting writer will not wake up because nobody signaled it. Another writer will come and find the room empty and overtake the waiting writer. And when that leaves, it's still not going to signal the writer. So somehow readers have to... No, that writer will never wake up and readers will never be able to go in. WWC will always be one. So you'll get into a mess. That's wrong. Okay. So yeah, it looks simple, but there is a bit of complexity hidden behind it. Yeah, the fun of concurrent programming. Let's see, dining philosophers. Let me write it in English first. So I have to somehow have a count of available chopsticks, which I need to fix this code, but I'm now playing it fast and loose here. Check your left and right chopsticks. If one of them are not available, that is, not both of them are available, then you have to go to sleep. And it's inside a while, because if you get woken up, it doesn't mean your chopsticks are available. It means maybe one of them became available. So you've got to recheck this, because your neighbor will wake you up when he or she is done eating, but that means the neighbor has put down a chopstick, but he or she is not going to check your other chopstick. Okay, so I should be a little, maybe I should write the code, or you'll help me write the code. I didn't write the code, this is English. If both your chopsticks are not available, go to sleep. If you get woken up, check again. And if you drop through the while loop, make both chopsticks unavailable. This is a critical section, so this will be atomic. When you're doing this,
make chopsticks unavailable, that means you pick both of them up?
You pick both of them up, yeah. And put down will be make them available, you're putting them down. And wake up your neighbors. Two neighbors, everybody has two neighbors. And just because you woke them up doesn't mean their chopsticks are available. They have to check again. That's why you did a while loop, they will do a while loop. Okay, how do we write this in more correct coding fashion rather than English? So instead of available, let's say chop. So I have five conditions and five integers saying chopsticks are available or not available. So pick up for the ith philosopher will be while not. How do I test? Which chopsticks do I test? Chop. What are the indices? 2. two of them. I and I plus one?
Modify.
Okay. I don't have space there. This will be double that and okay. And inside the while will be and outside the while will be chop I equals chop I plus 1 mod 5 equals 0. And that's pretty much it. Now, give me the two indices. I've got to signal two philosophers. I minus one. Now, there's a little problem here. Okay. So one of them is, of course, I plus 1, but it's mod 5. And the other one is I minus 1. Now, I minus 1 has a problem. What is the problem?
If it's 0,
you get a negative. So how do you fix that? Without going into a lot of if negative, then change it to that, then take mod 5. So no subtracting. Do it without subtracting. Anybody? The five philosophers. That's why it's mod 5. So how would you find the other neighbor without subtracting?
Can you use a pointer?
Yeah. I need a number. It's an index. What if it's 0, then, yeah.
Would it be like plus 6 mod 5 or something like that?
Not plus 6, but you're close. If you're 0, what should the number be? 1? I plus 1 is 1, I minus 1 is 4. So, I plus 4 sounds good? Yeah. And if you're 4, I plus 4 will be 8. That'll be 3. 8 is 3, yeah. If you're 4, it'll be 3. I plus 4 will be 8, mod 5 will be 3. If you're 3, it'll be 7, which is 2. So it keeps going down. That sounds good. So yeah, I didn't want to write this down. It's like y plus 4? What the heck is that? It's going backwards, actually. Yeah. Yes, it's 1. Thank you. Okay? Any questions? Yeah.
Would you start initializing all the chopsticks to be available before
they... Oh, yeah, should be available. I got available and unavailable mixed up. Okay. Now maybe it's correct, unless if you find another mistake in here. Let's see, how much time do I have? I have a little bit of time. Okay. Yeah, oh, you had a question? No? No. Okay. Any questions? Anybody? We quickly went through producer-consumer, starvation free readers and writers. Oh, this has starvation. Why? This is not a starvation free algorithm. The starvation-free algorithm is hard. You've got to add states of hunger, and if you're not careful, you'll end up in a deadlock. So you've got to figure out how not to eat, even though your chopsticks are available, and so that your neighbor can eat first, who's more hungry than you are. But you've got to be careful that it doesn't happen that since everybody gets hungry, they all sit with their chopsticks down waiting for the neighbors to eat. And that would be a deadlock. Okay? So anybody want to tell me where the starvation is? Yeah.
You know what I happened right after we got on the site, any other index can take up the
topic? Yeah, but that won't happen. If you signal the two, they would go first. And so either they're not wanting to, or if they are, then you'll find your chopsticks are gone, or one of them is gone, or both are gone. So we have the assumption that when you signal, that signal process will go before you re-enter. Neighbors alternate eating. One neighbor woke you up from this side. He's put his chopsticks down. But this guy is eating, so I can't eat. I go back to sleep. Then this guy signals me that he's put his chopsticks down. But by then, this neighbor is eating. So I check, then this neighbor starts eating. Then this neighbor puts it down. I still can't eat. Then this neighbor starts eating, and this neighbor puts it down, I still can't eat. And they could alternate, overlapping alternate. Okay, that's the starvation. That one's difficult. So that's not problem with these concurrent programs. That you can try and use things that makes it simpler to look at, because this is quite self-explanatory. But there's still stuff hidden there that's not obvious from the code. It's essentially how it works. And you've got to be a little careful of that. So, if we talk about monitors versus semaphores, monitors are a little higher level. They have much more sophisticated semantics. They have more structure, especially if you do it in an abstract data type kind of thing. But what is the relative power of monitors over semaphores, or vice versa? Which one's better in a... in the sense of, is there some functionality in semaphores or monitors that's not in the other? Maybe if I said, which language is better, C or C++? One runs faster. No, I'm not talking about speed. I'm talking about capabilities.
They're the same.
What about assembly versus C? No. For example, you cannot read a stack value in C. You can in assembly. But you say you can use assembly inside C. That's a different story. In pure C, you cannot do many things. Get a value of a register, you cannot. Okay? There's no concept of registers in C. So, is there such a difference between monitors and semaphores? The answer is they're equivalent. That is, they're exactly the same in power. Whatever you can do in one, you can do in the other, and vice versa. But the more interesting question is, how do you show they're equivalent? Just because I said that they're equivalent doesn't mean they are. How would you go about showing that monitors and semaphores are equivalent? That they can, what did you say?
You have to prove that they can handle some set of tasks.
They can both handle synchronization and critical sections. So they should be equivalent. But that doesn't clearly say, is there something, maybe semaphores have these queues and they can do more complex synchronization than monitors can do. I'm not so sure. Now, I cannot come up, this is a proof by example will work if I can show you a program that you can write in semaphores and you can't write it in monitors, or the other way around. But I can't find any. So because they are equivalent. So how do I show they are equivalent? Yeah.
You can implement one using the other.
You can implement one using the other, both directions, right? So if I implement monitors with semaphores, what does that mean? No, let's do it the other way. That this way is easier. This will show, if I could show you how to implement semaphores with monitors, and I'll show you how to do that, what will that prove in terms of superiority? You want to guess? Yeah. Anything that the semaphore can do, monitors can also do. So, which one's better? So I want to put a greater than or less than symbol in there. Okay? Monitors are better. In fact, I should put an equal here because it doesn't really show it's strictly better. It's not worse because I can implement semaphores with monitors. And if I can show that I can do the reverse, then it'll be semaphore greater than equal to monitor. And then with the two together, I can show equivalence. Right? This one is quite easy to do. This one's harder. So implement semaphores with monitor. What that means is that you do not have semaphores. You only have monitors. Can you make up the semaphore functionality? What is the semaphore functionality? It consists of three functions: initialize, P, and V. So implement or write the code for initialize, P, and V without using semaphores, using only monitors. Without using test and set, without using anything other than monitors and straight code. So for this, for each semaphore, I need a counter and a condition. And that's the code. So instead of having a semaphore, I'm saying let's have a structure which contains a counter and a condition. The semaphore is replaced by a struct with count and a condition, integer and a condition. The P operation will become decrement the counter field, and if the counter field is less than zero, do a wait on the condition. So go to sleep. And the V routine will be increment counter. If the counter is less than equal to zero, then wake up somebody who's sleeping on the condition. And that will have the exact same effect as PNV as described. So that's implementing semaphores with monitors. How do you do the reverse? Any questions about this? How do you do the reverse? I'll have to find where I kept this. Have it in a different format so it won't match up. What am I doing here? I've gotten a little confused. Okay, let's try. Okay, let me go. So, firstly, every function, so I take a monitor. In the monitor, there are some functions. In the functions, there's a wait and a signal call, or multiple wait and signal calls. I'm going to rewrite that using a semaphore. So for so I'm going to assume that there is one condition For every monitor, I will have a semaphore call mutex, a semaphore call next, a counter call next count. For every condition, I'm assuming there's only one condition in this monitor, there could be multiple, and this condition is called X. So I have a semaphore and a counter for each condition. And now things get a little messy. The function which is the method in the monitor will be replaced by a regular function which will have a P mutex at the beginning and some V mutex at the end, which is somewhere at, not here. P mutex in the beginning because it's in the critical section. If there is a wait, I increment X count, which is the number of processes waiting on the X condition, and okay, I increment X count. If next count is greater than zero, I do a V next, else do a V mutex, and then I go to sleep. What's going on here? Ignore the next count for the time being. So that's my wait routine. I'm trying to go to sleep. I have to go to sleep. This is the number of people sleeping on the X condition. So I increment that I'm sleeping on the X condition. There can be more than one. So I open up the critical section, go to sleep. When I wake up, I decrement X count. But it's possible that I'm going to sleep, but there's somebody who is sleeping but has already been woken up because of some reason. They should be allowed to go the first before anybody else is allowed to. So I check. Next count is the number of processes that are waiting to enter the critical section on a higher priority queue than outsiders. So instead of doing a V mutex, I pass the token, I hand over the critical section to that process. Then I don't open the critical section, I give it to that process, go to sleep. When I am woken up because of a signal, I will be handed over the critical section, that's why I'm not reacquiring it. I decrement X count and continue. I think the signal part is more complex. I may have missed some code here. No, I didn't. If some thread signals another thread, you check the X count, signal on X. You check the X count, is there anybody sleeping? If not, you do nothing. If somebody is sleeping, then you wake it up, but you do not let it run. So you make it wait on the next semaphore. No, you increment next count and you go to sleep. Okay, you increment next count, you go to sleep, wake the sleeper up and you go to sleep, and when you wake up next, you go to sleep on the next semaphore. So this is the semantics where the woken up process goes first and you go to sleep, and you will be woken up when that process exits or goes to sleep again. And I'm missing the exit routine. There is an exit routine which is kind of funky. Oh, it's here. then it should be here too. Now it makes sense. This is the signal, and this is the exit routine is anybody normally exiting the monitor would normally should be doing a V mutex because you enter through a P mutex, but you don't. You check if some of these high priority people need to enter the monitor. If so, you hand over the critical section to that one high priority process and you don't open the critical section. You've got to flush the next queue. Okay? So maybe I should. This one, I think you should take a good look at this and try to unravel how it works. So far I've been explaining everything. I'll leave this to you. Okay? It's important that you work out something. You know how it works in the sense overall. Something comes in, goes to sleep. Somebody signals, then he goes to sleep and the signal process has to wake up. If the signal process leaves, the signaler has to wake up next before anybody from the outside can come in. And there could be more than one signaler and more than one sleeping processes. So all that has to be orchestrated. That's why this code is tricky. But this is a good exercise in trying to unravel the mystery of semaphore programming. But you can go like, I don't need to understand this, I can use monitors. But this clarifies your thinking on how concurrent programs behave. Okay, any questions? What out of time I am? Yeah, I have 1 minute. Sure. I won't allow it. Okay. Laptops are, yes, you can bring in, but if you start Googling or communicating, that's a problem. So stay off the internet.
So a PDF book?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you have to.
I'm already up. Why can we meet starvation? Or the alternating, why your neighbor can eat and the other one still eating and then you can't eat. Can you help explain that? I'm probably going
to. Oh, in real life terms, you found you have both neighbors are eating. Okay? One of them quits eating, goes away. This guy is eating. This guy who went away comes back. Since he took a break, he let you go first, you didn't, he can start eating again. Now this guy leaves, but this guy is keeping on eating. Then this guy comes back, he can eat, his chopsticks are there. And at that point, this guy leaves. So it's never that you have both chopsticks. Either this or this is eating. That's what causes
it. So is it just with that specific code that makes that happen? Or is it just
that specific code allows this to happen. And how do you disallow, like you have to think of an algorithm where what should these people do? So this guy should check that I have not eaten for a while and not start eating. If so, then it cascades down to both of us kind of wait for each other. That shouldn't happen either. So.
And in the code is I refers to philosophers, right? Not the chopstick. right?
I is both a philosopher and a chopstick. I is an index. There are five philosophers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Mm-hmm. There are five chopsticks, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4.
So why in the pickup do you set I to, or set I?
Let's